I hope you had a nice break and are ready for the big slide into the end of the term. I know it's a tough time for you guys, and I'm going to do my part to add to that. Anyway, so welcome back. Just a reminder, you know, your Mammoth Thursday during class time in this room. We have a Q&A session today, 5:37, so it's an opportunity for you. It'll be in here. Normally, I don't have that many people to show up, so it'll be a bit ridiculous. But that said, if you have any questions about the material, you're welcome to come ask me then. I'll do my best to just give you as straightforward an answer as I can. Basically, I'm willing to sit here and do that for around questions. It's usually about an hour and a half in. I sent an email to a class. I have a slew of emails coming from students the last couple of days. I was traveling yesterday and couldn't. If this is anybody's, I guess it's up here because somebody lost it. I didn't have a chance to answer until this morning, but many of those questions were relevant for the whole class, so I just answered them all in an email. Does anybody have any other questions that I didn't address that they want to ask concerning the camera? No? Okay. Just also a reminder that the final exam is Thursday, December 19th, 7:15 p.m., and it will be in Hubble, so we have room to spread out. The problem this Thursday is you'll be on top of each other. The class will be, this room will be fairly full. So take what room you can and spread out, but sorry about that. So the exam coming up Thursday is basically on rotational dynamics mostly. So rotation with vectors and moments of inertia and torques and things like that. That means that up through equilibrium. So I sent the last, basically up to right where we start fluids. The first 20 points are about 11 quick right-hand rule problems. A cross B, what is the direction of the cross product? Here's a figure, what's the direction of omega? Here's a situation, what is the direction of alpha? Here's an R and an F, what is the direction of the torque, okay? Don't miss any of those points. They're just meant to be given you, so that if you don't know how to do that stuff. So I have to evaluate on it, I'm not. But don't miss any of those points. You're going to miss points. Miss them later on. Okay? But don't miss those, because they're meant to be given you. So everybody, make sure, right? This is your right hand. Okay? Because if you're using your left hand, it's minus 20 right at the start. So please, 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 don't screw that up. Okay? So, at any rate, that's Thursday's fun. So, I've moved on to fluids, and so last time we started talking about fluid dynamics, and what I mean by that is fluid in motion. And I think fluid in motion is really where things get to be a lot more fun with fluids. So the first thing we talked about was when we say a fluid, how we're dealing with it. One, it has no internal friction, which is viscosity. So think of molasses as very viscous. So think something more like water or pure alcohol or something that flows very easily. So the other thing is that we think of the fluid as being incompressible. And this is true whether it's a liquid or we'll deal with situations where it's a gas as well. But in this situation, if we have a container or a pipe which has a varying cross-sectional area as fluid flows through, basically as I shove some volume of fluid in from this end at some velocity, the same volume has to come out the other end. And if you look at conservation of the amount of material and relate it to the different cross-sectional area and the velocities, you get what's known as the equation of continuity. So at any given point in the system, if you have one part of a pipe and another part of a pipe, for example, then the cross-sectional area of the pipe and the velocity of the liquid at one point is going to be equal to the cross-sectional area of the liquid times the velocity at another point. So this kind of thing, you can imagine rivers that can spread out, have a large cross-sectional area, and move very slowly. Rivers that get constrained going through gorges and things like that rush through the very big velocity. Why? Because they have to get the same amount of material through per unit time, same volume. So that's basically what drives this. The next thing we looked at was basically simple energy conservation with fluids. And a way to think about that is if I am shoving a fluid in one end of a pipe and it has a kinetic energy of motion and it can have a change in potential energy as it's going in, if you think about energy conservation, when you put it in fluid terms, which means you basically turn the masses into rows, densities, then you end up with constancy of energy or energy conservation. If you think about what's happening at one point in the system to another point, the pressure is force per unit area. So when you start thinking about moving things through a distance, this is basically the amount of work that's being done on the fluid. This term is, remember, this is a mass per unit volume, so this is basically a kinetic energy term. So if I put pressure on a fluid and I can give it a lot of kinetic energy, so it blows fast through the pipe, for example, is a way to think about the energy stuff. And this is the change in the height times the mass. So this would be the gravitational potential energy term. So one of the things we looked at last time was what energy conservation means. And in terms of fluids, what energy conservation means is that at any given point in the fluid, this holds true. This is basically a constant. So you can compare it from one point in the fluid to another point in the fluid. And that leads to lots of sort of fun things. So one of the things we did last time was we talked about what happens with in baseball, for example, when you throw a curveball, you flick it like that, so it's coming at the batter. It has threads like this, which are a little bit above the surface, so they present a bit of friction as the thing passes through the air. And if it's done properly, this thing is flying with some velocity this way, and it is spinning with this sense. Okay? So, since it's flying through the air, that means the air is flowing past it like this. And because you have the threads moving this way on the top, they'll basically slow the flow of the air a little bit right over the top surface. Here at the bottom, it's spinning, okay, and it will actually push the air a little bit more. So you have V at the bottom is a bit bigger. Than V. So what you end up with Bernoulli's equation is if you assume that the height difference in the ball baseball is negligible between the bottom and the top of the ball, then if I say that this quantity is going to be true here and here, and you go, wait a minute, that's not a pipe, that's true. It's not a fluid, it's a gas. It's incompressible in the sense that it can move, and you can think of this as a fluid. And so we think of this as a flowing fluid, and this Bernoulli's equation will hold true on both sides. This term is negligible because it's basically H is effectively the same in each of them. So this is what we can set equal to one another. So P at the top plus 1/2 rho V at the top squared is equal to P at the bottom plus 1/2 rho V at the bottom squared. This V is a little bit smaller than V. This V is a little bit bigger than V because of this rotation and a little bit of friction that you have. So what that means is this is a tiny bit smaller than that, which means this pressure has to be a little bit bigger than that for this equality to hold true. So the pressure, the air pressure on the top of the ball is a little bit greater. And it causes the ball to literally pushes it down as it goes toward the bat, and that's what a curveball does. Okay. So that kind of thinking you can use for Bernoulli. You also may use it in pipes. I think I'll do an example on that right now. And we also talked last time about the airflow across the shape of airplane wings. Did anybody actually sit by a wing and look at that over the holidays? Yeah. Pretty cool, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So you have a similar sort of thing where you have an airfoil, so the air has to flow further on top than it does on the bottom, so it goes a bit faster on the top. All right, which means the pressure is greater on the top than it is on the bottom. Other way around. So pressure is, you're moving faster on top, so the pressure is less. So you have more pressure on the bottom, and that's what gives you the lift for the wings. Okay. And as you move slower to have the same amount of lift, because the plane mass is attaining, you need to have a more accentuated curve to the wing. You need more of an airflow shape. So that's why when they're going slow, they put their flaps down like this, so that you have more of this change in the wing shape. So we talked a bit about that last time. Anyway, let me now do an example which is more of typical of the kind of thing you see in problems, which is, I guess I'd call it a vat problem of some sort. So let's say that we have a big barrel with an open top. That has a spout. And then inside this barrel, we have a liquid. And the liquid's going to come flying out of this spout. And hit the floor. And I will tell you that this is open at the top. And we'll say that we have ambient air pressure. Sorry, it becomes clear to me this thing's not working. Just give me a second and see if I can. I'll try the old batteries that are probably also dead. Okay, we'll see if that works for any length of time. So what happens is you have a liquid in the bath, and the level drops as the water comes, or whatever the liquid is, comes flying out of the hole in the bottom. And we'll say that the height of the liquid here, I'll call it y1. The height of the hole, I'll call y2. And then we'll call this height y3. And when the water comes out, it goes a distance d where it hits the floor. And so in this particular problem, the question is for you to determine d itself. Okay? And a way to do that is to think of this as a pipe where you have one position. Well, we can think of it as a multi-step problem. It may be a fluid, but once you have an element of fluid flying out of this hole, it's a projectile problem. Right? So I have the fluid coming straight out of the hole, so that's as if I shot a ball straight, and I ask you, given a height above the floor, the ball comes out with a certain velocity, how far does it go before it hits the floor? And I hope you're all real happy with being able to do that. Okay? So that piece is just the projectile problem piece. Then there's another piece, which is to figure out what is the velocity at which the flow is coming out of the hole, the water is coming out of the hole. And now you can think of this as a pipe. So you have basically a big pipe here with the water flowing out through that. And so a way to do that is to take Bernoulli's equation, which tells you you have these quantities, pressure, 1/2 rho v squared, 1/2 rho g a. And that combination of quantities, which constitutes the energy of the fluid, is going to be constant at different positions. And so one thing you might ask, okay, what positions do I care about? What do I know about? Well, the top of the fluid, you sort of know something about. And you're interested in what happens right here. Okay? So let me look at, if I pick those as my two spots, let's look at them and see what we see. So I'm going to call this sort of a position one, and at the hole here, I'll consider that position two. And if we use Bernoulli's equation, then we have the pressure at position one plus 1/2 rho V1 squared plus rho G, whatever we mean by the height at position one, because we haven't defined our zero yet. In fact, why don't we go ahead and define the zero so this makes more sense. So let's define Y2 as zero. I define Y2 as zero for the fluid piece because I'm interested in this difference in height between these two. So if I define this as zero, then it's easy to figure out. I might decide to redefine it when I do the projectile thing or not. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can ask how far does it go before it reaches a distance which is minus y3 relative to zero. But let me define this one as zero. So now y1 effectively is the h. Okay. So I can then say rho g y1. That is Bernoulli's constant, the energy conservation piece sort of defined at this point. So now I want to do that for the second position, and I want to set those equal to each other. So that's equal to P2 plus 1/2 rho V2 squared plus rho GY2, but this I've already defined as zero, so that term is zero. And that's okay because really if you want to think about how this is flowing, you think about fluid that drops from here to here, so it is only this height difference that's important. And that we have in by defining this as zero and that's five. So you okay with this so far? So the tricky part for these problems is sort of the next step, because in order to pull these things off, you tend to have to read the problem carefully and sort of make some assumptions, okay? So one thing to notice is the problem has to specify whether or not the vat is open at the top. Why do I care? What do you think?
If it's not included, it must be creating a vacuum.
Yeah. If this isn't open, I don't know how to relate the pressure out here to the pressure in here. If it is open, I know exactly how to relate it, because now I know the pressure on the top of this is ambient air pressure. Okay? So that's trick number one to look for. I mean, it's a piece of information. So if that's open, then I know that that's the air pressure. Now, you might also ask, well, this is also open, And this height difference isn't so great. So I'm going to also assume that the pressure here is equal to the atmospheric pressure. If this were a very, very, very tall column or something, you might not be able to make that kind of assumption. So you've got to keep your eyes. It's not always the case that these two are going to be the same, although usually for these types of problems, if they're not the same, the way that you'll sort of find that out is this will be a closed top. So if this is enclosed, what I would know is that you have atmospheric pressure here where it comes blasting out. And now, either you get told and you have to figure out what's going on with the pressure up here because it's not clearly atmospheric pressure. All right. But I'm going to assume P1 is about equal to P2 because the height isn't very different. And we're going to set these both equal to the atmospheric pressure. When I do that, though, you'll see that it means that this and this cancel each other out, so they just disappear. Now comes sort of trick number two that you're not usually told and you have to think about. You're either, if they say large band, then this is a big diameter. Which means as fluid flows out here, effectively this level doesn't drop very fast. Eventually it will all end up on the floor, yes. But compared to this velocity, this is really small. If they say large bath, that means relative to this, I will set this velocity, the velocity of the fluid at this point, equal to zero. The term just goes away. Some problems may tell you what that velocity is, but you have to look for a clue as to what in the world to do with that water level, with that velocity at that point. And if they just tell you large bath, that is the clue to put into your secret decoder ring that tells you this velocity is effectively zero in the problem. We have that rho g y1 is equal to 1/2 rho v2 squared. Or v2 is equal to square root of 2gh or square root of 2gv1. And if you remember from things going down frictionless sliding boards and stuff like that, it's the exact same equation. Because basically you have conversion of gravitational potential energy due to difference in height into straight kinetic energy. So that all is happening in this particular problem. Okay? Lots of room for a lot of different things, right? I could put this in a pipe and ask for the velocity of the flow here, in which case the pressure is not the same, and you have other things. So there are lots of ways in which it can change, so this is not a general thing. But under this problem, it works out well that way. So now we have basically exactly the same problem as a kid who's gone down a height of a sliding board, comes straight out horizontally, and he asks, where do they hit the ground if they go fall a distance h? So now it's a basic projectile problem, and I'm going to assume that you'll know how to do that. Okay. Any questions on this? So I tried to point out sort of the gotchas, but clearly there are lots of things you can look for in doing some practice problems. Any questions on sort of fluid dynamics? Okay, so it's pressure, it's motion, it's relating, continuity. You can use the equation of continuity at different points in tubes to get velocities. Once you have velocities, you can use Bernoulli's equation to get different pressures and things like that. So, sort of the basics. Clearly, we could spend 3 days doing lots of fun problems, but I'm going to sort of like the windows and the problem stuff. So, anything on fluids? Next topic I want to cover is called simple harmonic motion. And often in books or whatever, you may see this just sort of referred to as SHM. And the way you should think about it is, it's just that motion. It's what you get with a spring if you just let it do its thing. Okay? And we're going to study it by itself because it's a pretty fundamental quantity. And lots of things sort of go back and forth because of the potential that grows in strength as you go up and down. So physically, it's fairly important. But one of the most fundamental reasons that we have to study it is what happens if you have adjoining particles which execute that motion and there is some connection between them as they do it in terms of how they do it. So the best example I can think of would be the wave in a stadium. Right? How does that work? You get in one section, somebody's standing in front, okay, everybody now, 1, 2, 3, and you do this, right? Everybody in that section does this, and then when they're getting down, the people over here start to do it, and then as they go down, people over here start to do it. And if they keep doing this, what you see is that everybody's just doing this. It's basically simple harmonic motion, okay? And if they all did it at random, it would look very random. But if you have this coherence between them, sort of something that controls when they do it, and that progresses, then what you get is a phenomenon that is completely different. And it's called a wave. And waves turn out to be really important in nature. There are sound waves. There are waves on strings. So all of music is just waves. When you get into physics 114, you're going to learn about electric and magnetic fields, and it turns out that the equations that you'll eventually get to that get at the core of those phenomena will show you that the electric and magnetic fields you describe in the field of electromagnetism also satisfy wave equations, and that when you put them together, you end up with a phenomenon of light. So light turns out to be a wave, very interesting and bizarre wave. And then it's even worse than that, because when you study particles like electrons in really gory detail, you find out they also have significant wave-like characteristics. They show all the same kinds of strange phenomena you'll learn to associate with waves. And so it turns out that matter is also made of waves, and when you solve the wave equation for matter, it's called Schrodinger's equation, out pops quantum mechanics. Okay? So I preface this because I'm about to bore you with some crap with simple harmonic motion. It's not in and of itself all that exciting. But trust me, this is the core of all modern physics. It is from this that you build your intuition about waves, and from waves you understand the coolest phenomena in modern physics and optics and things like that. So it turns out to be sort of important. And perhaps I belabor that a little bit because when I was taking physics for years, I didn't appreciate that somehow, and I got so sick of them talking about simple harmonic oscillation all the time, at every level. And finally it sort of dawned on me, oh, that's how this all fits together. But for me, that realization probably was in graduate school or something, so I hated this stuff. At any rate, it's not so bad, so hopefully you'll have fun with it. Okay, so what do we know about springs? If I have a spring, let's imagine that I have a spring which is connected to a mass, and I have a frictionless floor. So we effectively take gravity out of the problem in this case, and I have a spring attached to it. So I really only want to consider things in the horizontal direction. So if I have this spring and I stretch it out some, like so, if we assume that it has a natural length here, which I'll call x0, if I now stretch it out a distance here, which is x, that is x beyond its natural length, then what we know is that there is a force, which is a restoring force, that is, it's trying to put it back the way it was, which is, it's minus because it's a restoring force, a constant that describes the strength of the spring, times x minus x0. All right? So this we've seen before. And very often it makes sense to just think about the force of a spring in terms of its absolute magnitude as kx, where I set x0 equal to 0. Okay, so you really are only interested in how you change with respect to its natural length. And it's nice to sort of think of the magnitude where in your mind you just know that when I pull it out this way, it is pushing, it is pulling me back, and when I push it in this way, it is pushing me back the way I was. So it's a restoring force. So if you need to know the direction, you look at the problem and you put the direction in accordingly. Okay. So if we want to, let's not worry about the absolute value for the moment, but let's just say F is equal to minus KX, where the minus sign now, if you're in a one-dimensional problem, the minus sign is effectively what you're going to use to get direction if you need to in a one-dimensional problem. So the minus sign, where if X is positive, X minus X is 0, so that's effectively X. If it's positive, then the minus sign tells you you're going back that way. If it's negative, it's going this way. So that's giving you the absolute sign on the force. But F, we know, is equal to the mass times the acceleration. Acceleration is the second derivative of position with respect to time. So I can divide through by m,
And I get that the second derivative of position with respect to time is equal to k, I want to pull that over, plus k over m times the position is equal to 0.
So if I just take what we already know about strings and I put it in terms of just the position, then this is equivalent to this, where the m gets pulled down and I pull this term over to the other side. Drop the 2.
So the second derivative of position with respect to time plus k over mx is equal to 0.
This then,
if you really want to impress your grandmother, this is a second order ordinary differential equation. So if you have math friends that are taking differential equations, and
that's what you would tell them this is, okay, and then they would know what you're talking about. Ordinary here means you're basically in one variable and the derivatives you're using are one variable derivatives. You don't have partial derivatives here. Second order means you have a second derivative, okay?
And this then is what a physicist would call the equation of motion. For simple harmonic motion.
Basically, what I'm telling you is that when you have a string, you get motion like this. This now has the time dependence in it, so this is the equation that contains within it everything that you need to know about that motion. Okay? So that's why we call it the equation of motion. Now, if you take differential equations, or if you've had it already or whatever, then you know all about solving these things, but we're not going to be doing that in this class, okay? So I'm going to propose a solution to you and prove that it works, and then that's what we're going to study.
So let me hypothesize that x equals to some constant a times the cosine of omega t plus phi would be a solution. Actually,
I'm going to tell you about what these pieces are. It won't make much sense right now, but I hope it will in a little while.
This is a constant, which we're going to call the amplitude. This is a constant, which is the angular frequency. And this is a constant which we call the initial phase. And why we call them that, we'll be talking about the rest of the class. But let me just take this, and for the moment, I want you to think of this as nothing but a mathematical expression
where I've told you how to describe this x, which is in this equation, as a function of time, where now I have put in a strange form. It's in time and cosine, and I have a constant, and another constant. Okay? It's just a math problem.
So if I just to say that this is my solution, I can take the derivative of it. So the derivative of x with respect to time is equal to a, you pull out the omega, and the derivative of cosine is equal to sine. And then I take the second derivative, so I take the derivative of this. The derivative of a sine is minus the cosine, and I pull out another power of omega because I'm taking the derivative with respect to time. So I have minus a omega squared times the cosine omega t plus phi. And now what I'd like to do is to take this second derivative, plug it in here, and my solution and plug it in there and solve the equation. So the second derivative term becomes minus a omega squared cosine omega t plus phi plus k over m times the first piece, which is going to be a times the cosine of omega t plus phi. And this whole thing has to be equal to zero. And this is going to be true if omega squared is equal to k over m. Or that omega is equal to plus or minus the square root of k over m. Okay. Are you with me so far? Let me. So now, what I hope I've proven to you is that somehow the physics that governs simple harmonic motion, this F is equal to minus kx, when we put in what A, we get F is equal to ma. Put in what A is equal to, and we get what the mathematical relationship then has to be. There's a basic solution for what x can be, which is this. If we take this and we plug it in, we find out that this solution certainly works so long as we have a connection between what the omega constant is and the k over m. And that connection is this. So when this is true, that is a solution. Okay? Now let's look at what that solution is telling us physically. Let's look at. I want you to use your imagination for a moment and pretend that this thing is holding a pencil that is pointed like this, back and toward the wall, okay? And that I have a sheet of paper here that I pull along as this thing goes up and down. And so as I pull the sheet of paper along, the pencil is marking on the paper. Okay? So it's going to start at the bottom, and now I'm pulling the paper, and I let this thing go as I pull the paper rapidly this way. Alright? What you'll see is something that looks a bit like this. X in this case is the position of this thing. In our case, it's going to be up and down, okay, because this thing is moving up and down. And how that goes as a function of time might look something like this. If you can imagine now, as I pull the paper past this thing, what it's going to draw out as the paper slides is a curve that looks like that. Are you okay with me? Okay. That looks like a cosine curve, right? Clearly, depending on whether I start with t equals zero when the thing is passing the origin or not, it might look like a sine curve. So cosines and sines are really exactly the same thing, except we shift them over a little bit. We say the phase is a little bit different. So this curve is a curve of x equal to a cosine omega t plus phi, where this distance is equal to the amplitude of the cosine. Okay. We have a frequency here. Let me come back to that. If you imagine we have our ball, and I'm going to plot, sorry, I didn't specify this, this is time. As I pull the paper through, it effectively is giving me a time dimension, right? So this ball, you can imagine the paper is sliding this way. So things that happen earlier in time are things that are over here. So if the paper is sliding this way, the ball is moving down to give me this curve. It comes to the bottom, then it goes back up. So when it's up here, this part of the paper is now at that point. If you have that kind of situation, you sort of get this as your curve. Okay? So a way to think about that is there is a characteristic time where the ball goes through one complete motion and begins to repeat. So here, it goes down, the ball goes down, you're now here. As this slides through, the ball is going up. When the ball is right here, this point of the curve has moved to that point. Then the ball continues up. When it's up here, this part of the curve is at that point. And now it comes back down to here, which would be over here, okay? And then we repeat. So there's a characteristic time of repetition. You already see it, okay? I start down here. One, two, three, four. And so it goes one full bit of its motion. We call it one full. The amount of time we call it period. Okay, so the amount of time it takes to go through that one full motion, no matter where you start, it comes back to where it was. In this case, the symbol is a big T. And that is equivalent to the amount of time it takes for the ball to go through one full swing in its motion. That would be a period. That's a period.
Just doesn't, I mean, it's going to be the same. It just depends on where you start as to how you visualize it. Okay? So it is the period of repetition of this cosine, if you want to think about it. So now, to enforce that, what we say is when we say we want that period to be when the motion is repeating, it means that we have to write the equation in such a way that when I allow the time to go one full period in time, the cosine repeats. And cosines and sines are great because that's exactly what they do, is they just keep repeating the same thing, okay? So this is the time-dependent piece, and what I want to do is to put something in here so that whenever I go through a time change of one period, I get come back to the same value of cosine. So I can do that if I set omega equal to 2 pi over the period. Every time now that this time increments by one period, I get an integer here, which is a multiple of 2 pi. Right? This period, when it can be 0, the cosine is going to be 1. When this is one period, I have 2 pi times one period over period. That's just cosine of 2 pi, which has a value of 1. When I have t equal 2 times the period, I have 2 times 2 pi, which has the cosine value of 1. So I keep coming back to the same thing. So it's a harmonic function, it's a periodic function, and I enforce that by putting something in here such that every time this increments by a value of this, I get an integer times 2 pi, and the cosine comes right back to where it was. So omega represents what we call the frequency of the cosine curve. It gives you the time periodicity of the cosine wave. Phi is called the initial condition. If I set phi equal to 0, then I have exactly a cosine function here. It's equivalent at t equals 0, starting with this thing up part. If I wanted to make it a sine instead, or a cosine of the first term plus, I would have first term plus pi. So I'd then be starting at a different position. So it's the phi is a constant that you use to set the initial condition. Basically, I say at t equals 0, where's the ball? And this equation has to work for whenever t is equal to 0, so that's what that constant represents.
I heard that somebody back there is like, okay. So let me look at it a slightly different way that may also help you think about this. Now pros at circular motion. So let us think about having a circle where we have a ball on the circle that is rotating in that direction with angular frequency omega. And I'm going to say that here's a line that joins the origin to the ball. And at any given moment, that line makes an angle theta with the x-axis. And if I say that this distance, which is the radius typically, we're going to call the amplitude, or big A, then this distance, y, is going to be equal to a times the sine of theta, and this distance, x, is equal to a times the cosine of theta. But if this thing is going around with an angular velocity omega, theta is equal to omega times t if it's constant. So we're going to say this is constant. So this is a times the sine of omega t, and this is b times the cosine of omega t.
So I don't know if this makes any sense, but I'd like you to imagine that we have a light over here, and we project the shadow of this ball on a screen over here. Okay. When it's here, you're in the middle, and then as it goes up, you'll see the shadow of the ball will move up to this point, and then it will come, as the ball rotates around here, the shadow will come down to this point, and then it will go back up. And from this mathematics, you can see that the y position has this simple harmonic form, exactly like we were just looking at. It's an amplitude times a harmonic, in this case it's sine, but it could have been cosine if I labeled those differently, omega t. So it has a frequency, and the frequency of this cosine, or the harmonic, the sine or the cosine, is the angular frequency of this motion. So, let's see if we can get this to work. I'm just going to leave this here for a second and come back to it. Here is a machine that's set up to spin this ball around in a circle at a certain angular frequency. And if you look at the projection on the wall, okay, it's going to look a whole lot like simple harmonic motion. Not perfectly, I can't hear you, it's a different screen. Projecting out and looking at this linear motion that's a product of this circular motion. So this strangeness of having sort of linear motion and trying to use a mathematical description that has omegas and stuff in it basically comes from that kind of thing. You're looking at a projection of the circular motion onto the linear world and looking at how it reacts. Or what it looks like there. All right. So one of the things that's sort of magical in this is we derive this using a very particular equation, like that of the string. But really, what we started with was a mathematical equation that has the second derivative of some position variable plus a constant times that position variable is equal to zero. If I solve this equation, it doesn't matter where it comes from. The solution is the same mathematically. So when I solve this, I get a harmonic solution that is simple harmonic motion. It looks just like a string, where the frequency of that motion, the square of this is equal to this k over m, or the constant, whatever it happens to be. In this case, we solved for a string. But anything that exhibits that kind of mathematical formulation, that is, the force is restoring and it is proportional to the distance that this thing moves, you will get simple harmonic motion. And you can write down the frequencies. So you might say, well, I don't care. Well, suppose you want to be a theoretical chemist. What is a chemical bond? A covalent bond is one where you have two nuclei surrounded by electron density, okay? Like charges repel, unlike charges attract. So you can imagine I have positive charge and positive charge. If I had nothing else, they would repel each other. But I now take all this electron smear of density that's between it, which attracts it. If they move really close, there's less electron density. I have more positive on more positive, so they move apart. As they move apart a lot, you have more electron density, and you have more negative between them, it pulls them together. Okay? So when you actually look at how the equation works here, it is very much just like a string. And you can write down the net force as a function of where you are, right close to equilibrium position. You get an equation of this formula. In this case, you won't have k over m because it's not a string, it's other stuff. You'll have a different constant, but you can immediately write down the frequency with which these atoms will vibrate. And that turns out to be really important because molecules absorb and emit energy due to these vibrational modes of interaction. Yet quantum mechanics, you learn that only specific ones can exist. Classically, you can have any of these different vibrations. But it turns out that this basic form of mathematics, anything that exhibits this basic form, you can immediately write down the frequency of which the single vibrates. You could look at the same thing if you have a flagpole. You want to know what frequency will it vibrate. It might be anything, or if a musical instrument, for example, which might be something like a xylophone. You have this metal plate, and you look at what happens when you exert a force on it. What you'll get is a vibration of a certain frequency, which you can get out of an equation like this. So we use a very particular example, but I'd just like it to sort of grasp the fact that this is far more general than that. So the first example that I want to do with that is something which we call a simple pendulum. And I don't mean to be offensive by calling it simple harmonic motion and simple pendulum and stuff like that. It really has particular meanings. In the case of a simple pendulum, what it means is that you have, if you want to think about it, you have a ball hanging from a string, and it's a simple pendulum if the mass of the ball is so much bigger than the mass of the string that you sort of ignore the fact that the string has any mass at all. If this thing is a big, thick beam, then the solution is going to be different. And we don't call it a simple pendulum, we call it something like a compound pendulum. But that's what the word simple means. It doesn't necessarily mean this is meant to be trivial. Okay, so if I take this ball and pretend for a moment this isn't going to work too well because it's a string, but pretend for a moment this is a string that doesn't stretch. And I take it and I move it off to the side. That just doesn't work, never mind. Picture. I have a string, I have something hanging from it, and I pull it off to the side and it just goes back and forth like this. Okay? Now you might imagine, because it moves back and forth with a very particular period, that it might exhibit simple harmonic motion. Okay? So what I'd like to do is to actually look at this and see if we can figure out what is the frequency of its motion or what is the period. The two are exactly related. Right? 2 pi over omega is the period. Is sort of the angular frequency. Very often people will talk about a frequency f, which is sometimes defined as just 1 over the period, because you're not really talking about the angular frequency. We'll see examples of that, I think. So let's look at this for a moment. Let's imagine that this ball is going back and forth, which means it basically executes circular motion as it goes back and forth. And let's say that this is angle theta, and that the string has a length L. And at any given moment, the ball is off to one side. The forces you have are the tension force, and you have mg down. Okay? So if we want to microanalyze this thing, we want to make a free body diagram of it. Let me draw the ball here. And I know I have the tension, like so. And I know I have mg, like so.
And since the ball is executing circular motion as it moves back and forth, I know that the net force this way must equal mv squared over r at any given moment. And because you sort of think of it as circular motion, what I want to do is to work on an axis which is going through the ball to the center of the circle, and an axis that's tangential to it. So those axes change with the ball. When the ball's down here, it'd be like this and like that. When the ball's over here, it'd be like this and like that. Okay. So in this case, I'm going to say that my axes are like that. And this angle is theta, if you can see that. I've defined this as theta. When I project it over here, this is the angle you make with this line. So it's the angle that the vertical makes with that line. So it's that opening angle right there. So this component is mg times cosine of theta, and this component of mg is going to be mg times the sine of theta. You okay with that? I'm going to call this direction the perpendicular direction. No, I'm sorry. I'll call this is sort of the radial direction, and this I'll call perpendicular direction or tangential direction. So if we look at the force that's in the tangential direction, that's going to be equal to the mass times the acceleration in the tangential direction. So what I'm asking, what I'm saying is, here's the ball, I have a string going up this way, I have a component of gravity going down that way, this is along the radial line. But I have this unbalanced force that's this way. So that's going to be trying to move the ball back. As the ball moves over here, I have this force that's growing in magnitude as I go, and it's acting to decelerate the ball and accelerate it going from here back that way. So it acts as a restoring force. The magnitude of that is going to be mg times the sine of theta. That is an unbalanced force that's tangential to the motion. Okay? So there's an equation. Look what happens if I plot theta versus the sine of theta. When you do that, you get a curve that looks like that. If I say, let's plot theta versus theta, I get a curve that looks like this. And one of the things you might notice when you look at this is if you look at very small theta, that is right in here, those two curves are sort of indistinguishable. There are other ways to look at that. If you're into calculus and you've heard of Taylor series expansions, if the Taylor series expand sine theta, you find that it goes as theta minus some theta squared term plus some theta cubed term, etc. For small theta squared is really small, so you basically can just drop it. All the higher orders of theta are small and you can drop them. So that sine theta is approximately for the theta, the very small theta.
For cosine theta, it's approximately equal to 1, right? Because cosine theta does this at 0. So when you go to very small theta, it's right at the value of 1.
So this is like trick number 392 in some physics major's tool book, where we say that sine theta is approximately equal to theta for small theta. If you're physics majors, I drag you through Taylor series expansions, and you better know when to pull this out and when not to pull it out. In this class, I want you to be comfortable about the fact that this happens, but I'm not going to expect you to pull that out in some arbitrary position. Okay? But be aware of it, because I want to pull it out right here. If we have it, then notice, if I say that rather than take this ball and have it go back and forth like this, I take it and I have it go like that. Okay, then it would be small theta. Near the equilibrium position, if you want to think about it that way. So, yeah. In that case, let's look and see what happens. I have MA perpendicular is equal to MG sine theta. Here's theta, here's L, this is the arc length S. So when we talk about A perpendicular, we're really talking about the variable S, the arc length, okay, the change in it, second derivative of it with respect to time. So we have m times the second derivative of s with respect to time is equal to m times g times the sine of theta, but for theta small, we just put theta. S is equal to L times theta, so theta is equal to S over L, where L is the distance of the string. So this is m g s over L. One other thing is that it's minus sign because it's sending it back toward the direction from which it came. So that's restoring. So I dropped the minus sign, sorry. So now if I pull this term over, the m's cancel, so I have gs over L. Notice I have a second derivative of s with respect to time plus a constant, which is g over L. This is gravitational constant, length of the string, times this variable s. S is the arc length in the motion for this thing as it goes back and forth. This form is exactly this form. We've already solved for it, which means the ball, the pendulum, is executing simple harmonic motion along its arc length, where the frequency of that motion is equal to g over L. Instead of the k over m, you now have the g over L. If I know the frequency, I know the period. So what this says, if I make a pendulum, doesn't matter what the mass is, depending on the length of the string, if I pull it just a little ways and it goes back and forth, I just determine what its frequency and or its period is. Okay? By using, I don't have to pull out sines and cosines to do this and make a proof that this is simple harmonic motion, because this equation is of exactly the same form as the one we've already solved. And we can literally just write down the frequency. Good luck on Thursday.